Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Tim, Governor Sean Parnell seeks a much smaller annual appropriation for the proposed Susitna-Wautena Dam north of Anchorage. This dam could be in jeopardy. It's been a dream for many Alaskans, especially many Alaskan builders and contractors for a long time.
Michael, it could still stay on schedule. This is a setback. The governor cited a couple of reasons. One, obviously, is the shortfall of money this year, a smaller capital budget. He's got to spread the money around, and this is one place where he's going to spend a lot less than he did last year. The project still has money from prior appropriations, and it's moving forward in its studies, but this is going to cause them to reschedule things a bit. It's going to result in about a year delay.
I believe the figure that was in the budget was about $10 million, is that correct?
$10 million they're getting this year.
That's what I mean, yeah.
But they need to finish the studies and file the FERC license, which is the important event in the project. They need about $100 million more, $110 million total. So including the $10 million this year, they need another $100 million to complete the environmental studies that the FERC licensing requires. So what that means is that instead of filing in the late 2015 quarter, which they had hoped to do, they pushed it to 2016. But that assumes they're going to get $100 million.
And this version of the dam is scaled down from what was discussed 30 years ago.
Oh, right? That's right. 30 years ago, we were looking at two dams and a much bigger project, much more power, to the point that they didn't really know what to do with all the power. This project is one dam. It will generate about, capacity of 600 megawatt, which is about half the rail belt demand, power demand.
And my memory of the discussion of this particular dam was, or the presentations that I saw, that it wasn't so much Alaskans were going to get cheap power along the rail belt. What they were going to get was guaranteed power.
That's right. It also guaranteed stable price.
Right, Michael. Right.
The projections I've seen are the price of power from Wautena would be about the same. We're generated with natural gas now. So what it protects you from is price increases from natural gas and higher power rates. But down the road, many years after the bonds are paid off, it'll be very cheap power. And, of course, that's a benefit our grandkids enjoy.
So one thing I was curious about is this more a budget issue or more of an access issue that drove kind of the budget decision?
The governor cited problems with getting agreements with Alaska Native Village corporations who own land in the area. And he said he's not going to spend a lot of money on it until those agreements are signed and in place. You can look at that a couple different ways. You know, one is a bit of a, this is all a negotiation, of course. And one way to look at it is, village corporations, if you want to, be on board with this thing, this train's going to go by if you don't. And the other way of looking at it is the villagers are pushing back, and they don't think that they could get the right kind of deal from the Alaska Energy Authority.
Let's get Paul in here. Paul, your assessment.
I really have not much to add. I wonder sometimes, though, if we have the big gas pipeline from the North Slope to Tidewater with takeoffs, I wonder how much the pressure will still remain to build this dam if we have cheap, accessible natural gas by the bucketful, you know.
Well, that assumes, of course, we're going to get a big gas pipeline, and we don't know that yet.
Yeah, we don't know that, do we?
And then also, that gas is really designed for export. It's an LNG project. The Alaska takeoff, we don't know how cheap it's really going to be. But one thing, and it goes to the benefit of hydro, is that once you build it, big upfront capital costs, but it's stable. And the price of gas, we are still going to be linked into a world energy market. If the prices go up, gas prices go up, our costs go up.
Okay. Jill, a Tetitlik administrator, the village, is off to jail for misappropriating funds. How did this happen? What was the misconduct? And let's start with, where is Tetitlik, for those who don't know?
Tetitlik is near, I believe, south of Valdez in Prince William Sound. So it's a community that's off the road system. You have to fly there or get there by boat. It's relatively small. I think there were 50 households at the last population count. And this, excuse me, my voice is a little funny today. this issue with this woman who used to be the former tribal administrator, tribal president, came up after there was an election to replace a longtime leader there who'd been there something like 30 years and died unexpectedly. She called an election to kind of disempower the one who won the first replacement election. Then subsequent elections were called to disempower her. She lost, but she refused to cede power. And in that process, did what she could to make sure that nobody else had access to the tribe's bank accounts. And so the locals were very, very frustrated. But basically, she raided and plundered this account. She gave herself double salaries. She paid for, you know, activities like driving a private boat from the village over to Valdez when it was supposedly was for village business, but it wasn't, and got caught ultimately after, in an unrelated series of events, she'd gotten caught up in some drug cases and had a lot of personal problems. So it's a sad story.
And we're talking about a relatively modest amount of money.
Yeah, it was $100,000 or something.
But it wouldn't be big money in Anchorage, but it'd be big money in a small town.
It is big money in a small town. And so the fallout from this is that the existing leadership now, you know, in the wake after this woman, Lori Klum, who was also known by Sue Klum or Sue Johnson, is that they've had a huge mess to dig out of. The IRS had threatened to close them down if they didn't pay their $40,000 bill. That's a problem because they're the primary economic driver in this small little community, which is a problem in a lot of these communities that need the work and they need the money to so that their families can live and survive. A second one was a fuel bill went unpaid, and so the fuel distributor was refusing to come in and provide fuel, which is another huge issue because it's ghastly expensive to heat your homes, and it was forcing people to try to, you know, have to make decisions. What are we going to do? And they were very, very nervous, not to mention just the hurt feelings from all the, you know, the resting for power. This woman's attorney kind of characterized her demise and her bad decision-making born not so much out of the intent to deceit, but kind of an unskilled attempt to maintain power during what was kind of a big power battle within the community. But I think when you look at the case, in addition to, like, she had methamphetamine drug charges and other drug charges of, like, importation and alcohol importation, is currently facing something like 20 felonies in state cases.
Well,
she's really plagued by personal demons. And it came up in the federal court proceedings that some of those include the death of loved ones, among them being her own son who was killed by a drunk driver. So it's just a mess. And she has her own young child, and now she's headed to federal prison for, I think, 18 months. And so a lot of damage in a short period of time with, as you mentioned, a relatively low amount of money.
Well, Paul, supporters of the initiative that would legalize marijuana turn in 46,000 signatures to the lieutenant governor. It looks like pot will be on the ballot again in August. What do you think?
Dude, we've had a long history. We had a long history.
That was well delivered.
Thank you very much. We've had a long history in the state with marijuana. We've voted on it twice, 2000, 2004, 75. We had a Raven decision, the so-called Raven decision on privacy, which said you could have small amounts of marijuana in your home. In 98, we went for medical marijuana. And here we are again. This is an outside group, the Marijuana Policy Project out of Washington, D.C., mostly behind the drive to get it on the initiative on the ballot this time. We're going to have opposition soon from something called the Smart Approaches to Marijuana, another outside group. This is based on the one that's all going on the ballot, or should be on the ballot. It's based on Colorado's initiative that went into effect January 1st. So. It's been a long, hard road for the dopers, and we'll see what happens. The proponents of this say that it's already here, it's everywhere. Everybody already uses it. Government's not involved, and the people who don't want the initiative passed say the same thing. It's everywhere. Government's not involved. A terrible thing is going to be, and this is what the smart marijuana people are going to say: is that why would you want government in your dope process, taxing and regulating, and to that it's going to be a battle royal.
When the private sector through your local criminals can provide it to you,
dude, you can get it almost. I don't know this for sure. I've only read about
you
it.
You heard from a guy you met on the street. Okay,
I knew a guy.
Tim, from a legislative perspective, this is an initiative, but are legislators, Democrats, Republicans, have to get themselves involved in this?
I don't think so, Michael. I think they're not going to want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. I think what they'll say is, let's let the voters decide. But an interesting thought that just occurred to me, this will be on the August ballot,
yes,
if it's approved. So you're going to have this on the ballot along with the repeal, the oil tax giveaway. Yeah. So this is going to be really interesting.
A zoo is what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And but I think part of what you're saying there is all these ballot initiatives and the minimum wage have the possibility of making an unusually heavy turnout in typically be a down year.
Yeah, that's right.
Jill, I know you have not been covering this, but any thoughts?
Oh, no, not particularly. I'm from Colorado, so I've been back for some family visits, and it's been really interesting to see kind of the neighborhoods transform with these little pot shops that are up and running now.
But
they are all over the place. Yes, they are. They're like wine bars, but, So, and I think, Paul, you brought up that there might be this push to keep it in the private sector and kind of out of regulation. But I think that others could make a case that regulation would be a good thing because it's out in the open and it's no longer criminalizing an activity that's taking place anyway. And I think the tax was, $50 per ounce or something? I'm not sure.
It's going to raise a substantial amount of money for the state of Colorado and the municipality.
Tourism?
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, tourism.
In fact, that's true. One of the things that amazed me about the Colorado story was the people who had flown into Denver from Chicago, New York, Omaha, and other places to participate in the big moment as they saw it.
And they're going to have their big lawsuit eventually because they're only allowed to buy, a quarter of what a resident can buy? They can't buy the full amount, so.
Isn't that sort of like fishing regulations?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, Jill, the flu. Influenza is everywhere. And there have been reports of Alaskans who died, although there seems to be some lack of clarity about the number of them.
Well, I think that only recently did it become a regulation that the state had to track adult deaths. Previously, it was pediatric deaths that were classified and recorded and monitored. Doctors will tell you nationwide and probably in Alaska that every year people die from the flu. It's not uncommon. How many people are dying, I think, was harder to pinpoint. And it's a little bit of a challenge. You do the flu test, you find out what kind of flu you have. Those tests are, I think, generally reliable, but not always. This year we are seeing the swine flu make a comeback, the 2009 flu that was part of the pandemic that killed, I think, something like 14,000 people across the world. Here, it is part of the vaccine that you can get this year. So, physicians are saying, get the shot. We are in flu season. A lot of people are sick. And we've heard since this reporting requirement began at the end of December to track adult deaths that I think two adults have succumbed to the flu in the state of Alaska. But I know leading up to that in the fall, there was some concern that there was at least one or two other flu-related deaths as the flu season was starting and a big push for people who hadn't had vaccines to get them.
And my memory of this is when I got a flu shot myself and I had them over a number of years, whoever is providing the shot will explain to you that this doesn't guarantee that you'll never have the flu. What it does is diminish your chances and diminish the severity, right?
Right, that's the goal. And, there's lots of different types of flu, so there are always strains that are predominant in any given season. This strain, this H1N1, seems to be one of the predominant ones that they're seeing right now.
And I believe somebody you quoted in one of your stories said the only place you won't be exposed to the flu in Alaska is if you're off in the cabin in the Brooks Range.
Oh yeah, that was a there's a story just about other bugs too that people are getting around the state, and that's if you're in part of a community, you're going to be exposed to bugs, and inevitably you will get something.
Okay. Tim, the new year has come. Tell us what's in store for Alaska's oil and gas industry, one of our biggest players in 2014.
Well, Michael, just as it happens, Friday was the day of the annual Alaska Support Industry Alliance big conference where all the companies and all the contractors share what's going on. So it was very interesting. There are some new developments. This was expected, but Governor Parnell announced that the state will take a strong investigate the possibility of a state investment in the gas pipeline to get the project off dead center.
If I might, that was today. Today being Friday when we're recording this.
Right.
And he talked philosophy, numbers, or just philosophy?
He just talked the philosophy. And he sort of presented the how this sort of evolved from different your earlier efforts. There was the Stranded Gas Act by Governor Knowles in 2008, I believe, and that led to Governor Murkowski's effort in 2005 to put a deal together with the producers and also to have the state do a investment in that. This is very similar to the concept of what Governor Murkowski proposed. We had a sort of a different turn. That idea was not accepted by the legislature, so Governor Palin suggested a different approach, which was a RGGIA licensing approach with TransCanada. But with what Parnell did is he pointed the progression. I mean, this sounds like a lot of confusion, a lot of failed attempts.
So it was a large part that what we heard was a history lesson.
Right, yeah. But there is a steady progression of ideas and concepts and the evolution of this thing. So now we're back to another, maybe we're repeating ourselves, but he pointed in a positive direction. This is going to be a lot more open, a lot different than what was done before. So we'll see. And in terms of other things that are being talked about, the Point Thompson gas project is under construction on the
right.
slope. That's putting about 1,000 people to work this year, just like it did last winter. A new pipeline's being built. So a lot's happening.
And we should explain that new pipeline is being built from Point Thompson to where?
To Prudhoe Bay. Or actually, it's being built to connect with another pipeline. But in itself, it's only 20 miles. It's a 12-inch pipeline, but it's very significant in that it's the first infrastructure that's extended to the eastern part of the North Slope. So initially, it'll carry these liquid condensates from Point Thompson to the mix in with the oil at TAPS.
For industrial purposes,
yeah,
I guess.
But in the long run, it opens up a pipeline to serve oil deposits, oil development on the eastern North Slope. So it's significant in that standpoint.
And can you tell us anything about Cook Inlet in 2014?
Well, Cook Inlet will continue. It's seen a renaissance in the past two or three years. Hillcorp has really stepped up to the plate, invested. We have new gas production. We have new, more secure gas supplies here in Cook Inlet, which was a bit of a turnaround from what we looked at last year. Explorers are finding new gas. Fury Operating is planning a new platform next year to market gas that they've discovered. We don't know how much. It's a private company, so they don't have to say. A small company from Australia, Buccaneer, has found gas. So things are getting busy in the inlet.
Thank you, Paul. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell rejects the proposed SetNet ban initiative. What did the initiative say, and what did Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, through state attorneys, say in response?
It was offered up by the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance as a conservation measure for Cook Inlet salmon. It would have banned commercial SetNet and gill nets in Cook Inlet, supposedly all over the state, but the emphasis would have been in Cook Inlet, and that would have been only in non-subsistence areas. The Department of Law looked at it and said that it was going to amount to an appropriation by initiative, which is constitutionally barred. It would have shut down one area and given it to a smaller group, the commercial fishery, and given it to a larger group. And so they said that it was constitutionally barred. They couldn't do it. So he tossed it out.
And of course, the petitioners can go back and rewrite the petition and perhaps come up with some other approach, or they can appeal to court. They've got those alternatives.
They have not ruled out an appeal.
Okay, Jill, Alaskans remember the shortage of fuel that gripped Nome and the Nome region a couple of years ago, and the voyage of the ship Renda, the supply, benighted Nome and area with fuel. Now this story has devolved into a lawsuit.
Right, I think this was foreseeable, right? This was this historic mission from Dutch Harbor to Nome in the dead of winter with ice-choked seas and a Coast Guard cutter escort, navigating.
Made for great television,
just this incredible journey to this isolated city. But that situation came about after a different fuel vendor, Delta Western, was supposed to provide to the local distributor, Bonanza Fuel, this, one point some odd million gallons of fuel to help shore up the supplies for winter. They didn't get their delivery in on time. Bonanza then felt that it was a situation critical. They had to get this in order to have families be able to heat their homes and, for other services. So they found a different vendor who found this Russian flagged fuel barge that was ice class and could come in and do the journey. And so they kind of switched their distributors. They made the trip happen. But now we have the fallout. Who pays for what? Who breached what contract, if any? Could the original vendor have come in and made it work? It's not surprising that it ended up in court. There was a state court case. I believe there was an out-of-state case, and then there was this case in federal court. Delta Western has said it tried to negotiate and come up with a solution for Bonanza, but Bonanza just at some point cut off the discussion and said, we're not dealing with you anymore. We're going to go with these other guys. Bonanza has said that Delta could have and should have gotten it in sooner and didn't. What came out during court was one interesting point, I think, was that Delta Western actually used the same vessel that it would have needed to bring that fuel into Nome around the same time to the Red Dog mine and make a large delivery. So they have some internal communication indicating that at some point it wasn't just weather that had caused these delays, as was originally claimed, but some internal decision relating to logistics and other clients to kind of move ships and cargo around. I'm sure it was a calculated decision. I'm sure they had their reasons, but Bonanza sees that and says, aha, you deprioritized our region and our people. And, you know, you could have made it, but you didn't, and now you need to deal with it. So what's the end result? We don't really know. We know that they've been locked in this litigation for a year or two. Now there's a settlement. We don't know what the terms of that settlement is. They have about a month and a half to kind of decide, you know, hash out the final details and get it finalized.
And I guess since the government's not involved in this, there's a pretty good chance the settlement won't be public.
No, I can't imagine.
Okay. Tim, the municipality of Anchorage hires CH2M Hill to manage the redesign of the troubled port of Anchorage. Why has this consulting firm been brought in, and what do we expect from them? And explain this complication that they're involved in a lawsuit with the city.
Well, Michael, let me just say first that CH2M Hill is a long-established and very well-known, very reputable engineering company. The municipality asked them actually some time back to come in and take a fresh look at this thing and give new ideas. The company had not, as CH2M Hill, had not been involved in the previous designs, which involved some controversial designs for the port. The company did so, made some recommendations. The municipality put out an RFP to hire a firm to manage the reconstruction, not be involved in the work itself, but just to be the project manager. CH2M Hill was selected. They have a long track record of working in ports, port development, you know, all over the country. And so unlike the previous arrangement, which is done through a complicated arrangement through a federal agency, Merod was the project manager, which never had anybody here supervising the work, and that's what led to some of the problems.
And the lawsuit?
The lawsuit is a funny thing, but Vico Corporation did a small amount of work under the previous port project, and since CH2M Hill subsequently bought Vico, they assumed some of the liability. So you have this odd situation where the city on one hand is suing the company for some small amount of work that was done several years ago, and now, of course, CH2M Hill. The mayor says, though, that's really not a problem. He can wall off these different interests and make sure that the thing proceeds as planned.
Okay, thank you. Paul, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich both voted to extend unemployment benefits to the long-term unemployed. Murkowski was one of six Republicans to cross party lines and vote yay to prevent a filibuster. What did she say?
She said that the employment benefits can't be extended forever, that she would vote to avoid the filibuster, only to get to the final vote and Republican amendments to this bill. And without that, I don't know how, she didn't say how she would vote on the final vote. Senator Begich was in Hawaii at an aviation convention for this and had a fundraiser going on out there as well. So here we are. We get to Murkowski. She tends to vote, I think, to further the process.
That's becoming clear.
That's becoming clear. Yeah. She, on judicial appointments and things like this, she will vote to move the process along to a final vote. And I think that will come back and haunt her for people who don't understand exactly what it is she's doing later on.
And I'm wondering if Senator Begich gets some benefit from being essentially paired with Murkowski on these votes of voting the same way on some issues of that could be used for partisan purposes.
He wants to be seen, I think, as a moderate Democrat. She's a moderate Republican. I think it does him no harm at all. I think if anybody's heard in that pairing, it's her.
Paul, we have just a little time left, and this is something I didn't talk about when I was thinking up the agenda for this show.
Uh-oh.
But we can't miss this term and go through the show. The polar vortex. What a remarkable name for a storm. It made me think of somebody smoking something, so to speak, perhaps Ezra Pound. But in any case.
The polar vortex, yes.
Yes.
Used to be called the circumpolar vortex. And it's been around for decades and mentioned time and again in arcane meteorological text. And 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, Time magazine said it was caused by global cooling. And here recently it said it was caused by global warming. So you can take your choice on what caused it, but it's basically the end of the world.
And it's fascinating that I have a friend who lives near St. Louis, and they came close to the lowest temperature ever recorded in St. Louis.
Oh yeah, the 6 degrees in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Oh Lord, I mean, that would make you just run south.
It made you glad to be here and glad to be watching Anchor Alaska Edition. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.